Welcome to the Not Old Better Show. I'm your host, Paul Vogelsang. As part of our Smithsonian Associates Art of Living series, our guest today on the Not Old Better Show is Dr. Charles Calhoun. Dr. Calhoun will be at the Ripley Center in Washington, D.C., February 8th, 2018, to discuss his new book about Ulysses S. Grant.
What it appears to me to be true is that Grant's administration was really one of the most controversial of that time, indeed, in all of American history.
Of course, that was our guest today, Dr. Charles Calhoun. Dr. Calhoun is the past president of the Society for Historians, and over the years, he's received many awards and grants, including a fellowship from the National Endowment for the Humanities. He's author of a new book on the presidency of Ulysses S. Grant. Give a listen to today's show featuring a very interesting subject in U.S. Grant, and told by a very interesting person with great storytelling, passion, and research by his side. Welcome to the Not Old Better Show via Skype, Dr. Charles Calhoun. Well, Dr. Charles Calhoun, welcome to the show.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
Yeah, nice to be talking to you. My audience will certainly know the name Ulysses S. Grant. They'll know the presidency, maybe a bit about his role, President Grant's role in the Reconstruction of the United States. But what's new that we don't know about Grant's presidency that you've really uncovered and touched on in the book?
I think one of the most important things that struck me while I was researching this book was how much of a legislative leader Ulysses S. Grant was. Of course, we all recognize him as a great military leader, and there were some doubts about what kind of leadership he could exercise as president. But what I discovered is that after an initial kind of rough patch of getting used to political kinds of questions, he was really quite adept at working with Congress. He had a well-defined legislative agenda, and he was quite forceful in pursuing that agenda, not simply in sending messages to Congress. Presidents did not speak in Congress for their State of the Union messages in those days. They sent it on paper. He was quite effective in those messages. But not just that, but he also met with members of the Congress, House and Senate, regularly at the White House. Sometimes he did go to Capitol Hill. There's a beautiful room on Capitol Hill called the President's Room, and he would sit there and discuss with sometimes whole congressional committees, sometimes with individual senators or representatives to push his agenda. And what he was also quite adept at in pursuing this legislative work was in organizing what you might call a cadre of say, legislative lieutenants, sort of his Shermans and Sheridans from the war years. He made very effective strategic alliances with leaders of his own party, the Republican Party in Congress, and they worked quite closely together to achieve his ends. They didn't get everything they wanted, but this was something that really struck me about Grant's presidential leadership, that he did work hand in glove with many of the congressional leaders, and much more than Andrew Johnson did, his predecessor, who really fought tooth and nail with leaders of the Congress.
Well, speaking of Grant's cabinet, the Treasury Secretary at the time, George Boutwell, successfully lowered taxes, interest rates on government bonds, and the national debt. Those are some key political buzzwords, even today, still swirling around. So it really, perhaps Grant and his cabinet have been overlooked historically a little bit for some of this legislative work.
Yeah, I think that's true. If you look at Grant's inaugural address, he certainly discusses questions about Reconstruction, but even more, the number of words he devotes to economic problems. After the Civil War was over, there still was a raft of problems remaining related to the government's finances. Taxes had been raised very high during the war, of course, to finance it. Heavy, heavy borrowing to finance the war, and even the emission of paper currency unbacked by gold or silver to help finance the war. The question was, after the war, what are we going to do to adjust this financial system, the government's financial system, to peacetime usages again? During the Johnson administration, not much was accomplished, but Grant felt very deeply about this issue, almost as deeply as he did about Reconstruction questions, and he and Boutwell and their allies in Congress were able to lower taxes. The income tax, which was inaugurated during the war, was eliminated altogether, interestingly enough, in our own context.
Mm-hmm.
The tariffs were lowered. The interest rate on U.S. bonds was lowered. The national debt was reduced by something like 17% during his 18 years. And by the way, they ran a surplus every single year, the federal government did during Grant's years. Eventually, toward the end of his administration, he signed legislation to resume the payment of gold for the so-called greenbacks, the paper currency that was issued. So there was quite a bit of success in achieving their policy objectives in the realm of government finances. We did have, of course, the Panic of 1873, largely resulting from an economy that was, in a sense, overheated. Lots of investment in railroads. Railroad investments didn't pay off very quickly, and when there were troubles on the European money markets, they had an effect in the United States, and we had this great crash in September of 1873. Economic thinking and theorizing at that time was still, of course, quite primitive, and no one had any real solution about how to resolve the depression that resulted from the Panic of 1873, although Grant had some interesting ideas along the way that he eventually backed away from, including a public works program to try to put people back to work. This was not a sale he could make among the Republican Party leaders at that time, but it shows an interesting kind of foresight about what might be needed in that kind of situation. But Grant essentially embraced conservative notions that the way to get the economy back on track after the Depression was to instill faith in the United States currency, faith in the monetary system, and he adopted policies to that end.
We are with Charles W. Calhoun, Ph.D., who is the author of the new book, The Presidency of Ulysses S. Grant. Dr. Calhoun will be at the Smithsonian Associates Program Thursday, February 8th. There'll be a book signing at the conclusion of Dr. Calhoun's presentation. Dr. Calhoun, it's really just a pleasure, as I say, to talk to you. I think, again, my audience will know that Grant's presidency covered a very chaotic time in U.S. history, you know, with the war. And maybe Grant's presidency can be viewed that way, too, a bit chaotic. There are claims of corruption. There are claims that Grant himself was a vain man, not even really interested in being president. What did you uncover that made you think differently about Grant and this time period?
Well, it's interesting you say Grant not interested in being president. In 1868, when he was nominated, he was somewhat reluctant about it. But what you had in the Johnson administration was such a botch of Reconstruction, such a knockdown, drag-out fight between Andrew Johnson, who basically said the White South should just take over again in the southern states, and with little concern for the freed slaves. And on the one hand, on the other hand, Republicans in Congress who wanted to instill programs to uphold the former slaves and protect their right to vote, males, of course. So that when Grant became when there was talk about nominating him in 1868, he felt that all of that infighting in the national government had failed to resolve the questions that needed to be resolved in the South. And so, as he put it in a letter to William Sherman, one of his great lieutenants during the war, he said, I'm willing to be nominated because I want to secure the results of the war. And by that he meant not simply ensuring that the states didn't secede again, that wasn't going to happen, but rather that the attempted change of social structures and political structures in the South could be brought to fruition. And so he agreed to be run for president, and indeed he did devote a great deal of his time as president to those very questions. He pushed the 15th Amendment, the right to vote amendment, was passed by the Congress just before he became president, and in his inaugural address he said we need to ratify this, and he did push states around the country to to ratify it, to make sure it became part of the Constitution. He supported, here's his legislative leadership again, he supported laws, bills to enforce the 14th and 15th Amendment to protect civil liberties and the right to vote of African Americans. And those laws were passed. He did use troops on occasion to protect the former slaves' rights and to suppress the Ku Klux Klan. But what he ran up against, of course, was an intransigence on the part of white Southerners who, by hook or by crook, said to themselves, this is going to be a white man's government. So it's unlikely that anyone could have achieved real success, ultimate success, lasting success in reconstructing the South. But Grant gave it a tremendous effort and a great deal of energy in trying to bring that about. And a couple of years after he left the White House, he said, he was talking to a reporter, he said, we probably should have kept the troops there for perhaps as much as 10 years longer than the end of the war, just to ensure that these things were set in stone. But of course, that did not happen, and politically probably could not have taken place. But Grant was the last president to forcefully advocate civil rights in the South and throughout the nation until the Civil Rights Revolution of the Lyndon Johnson era.
Grant had a great deal of energy and exerted a great deal of effort behind foreign policy. You write that he was very active internationally, and that was one of the things that I was really personally surprised by. I didn't realize that. So, in addition to the other members of Grant's cabinet, specifically, though, the State Department probably deserves some credit for some of the things that they did under Grant's leadership.
Grant had a great Secretary of State. His name was Hamilton Fish. He was the one cabinet officer who stayed the entire time, all 8 years, and he did a tremendous job. He's regarded as probably the best Secretary of State of the 19th century, or certainly one of the best, and one of the best in all of American history. And yes, he was quite effective. And the most important foreign policy question that came up during the Grant administration was one, like so many of these other questions, that stemmed from the Civil War, and that was the so-called Alabama claims. During the Civil War, the Confederacy, newly formed, attempted government, had no navy. It bought vessels from English shipbuilders. They were later armed elsewhere outside of the English shipyards, and they went into service for the Confederate Navy, and their basic task was to attack northern merchant vessels on the high seas, and they were quite effective at that. After the war, obviously the owners of those vessels and the cargoes lost, and people in the government and Americans generally believed that Great Britain owed some compensation for the losses incurred by those vessels that were built in her shipyards. And so the Johnson administration had failed to achieve a treaty with Britain that couldn't pass muster with the Senate. They did get one, but it lost. And so Grant and Fish were very determined to try to get this question settled. Grant really felt that, it's possible that unless we do this, war might loom on the horizon. And so after very serious and long negotiations, a treaty was struck with Great Britain called the Treaty of Washington, and it did call for arbitration of the Alabama claims issues. It's sent to arbitration, and the arbitrators gave the United States $15.5 million in compensation for those losses. But there were other issues involved and solved by the resolved by the Treaty of Washington. One included the resolution of a boundary dispute in the northwestern part of the United States around Vancouver Island. The 49th parallel was supposed to go out to Vancouver's island, but it was a little uncertain about where the boundary was between Canada, whose foreign policy, of course, at that time was run by Great Britain, between Canada and the United States. And that boundary was resolved, again, by arbitration after the Treaty of Washington. And also, the Treaty of Washington resolved the question of Americans being able to fish in Canadian waters. These are less important questions than the Alabama claims, but they're still important in settling some long festering issues with Great Britain. And some people like to say that the successful completion of the Treaty of Washington plus the ensuing arbitrations really began the rapprochement between Britain and the United States, which of course eventuated in the alliance of the 20th century.
Ulysses S. Grant is the topic. We have been speaking with Dr. Charles W. Calhoun. Grant, of course, as controversial in politics as he was in military, will be the subject of Dr. Calhoun's presentation at the Smithsonian Associates Thursday, February 8th. There'll be a book signing, and the book, of course, is The Presidency of Ulysses S. Grant by Dr. Calhoun. Dr. Calhoun, thanks so much for joining us today. We really appreciate it. What a fascinating time of history.
Well, thank you. It's been wonderful.
My thanks to our guest today, Dr. Charles Calhoun, who will be presenting stories from the book, The Presidency of Ulysses S. Grant, at the Ripley Center in Washington, D.C., February 8, 2018. Dr. Calhoun's book will be available for purchase and signing following the presentation, and there are more details available at our website. My thanks as well to the Smithsonian team for all they do to support our interviews. As usual, we'll post links to everything. And also, as usual, my thanks to you, the listeners, for joining me today. Your time is valuable, and I'm grateful you're spending some of it with me today. I'm always interested in feedback, and you can leave it at iTunes, Google Play, or send me an email at info@notold-better.com. That's info@notold-better.com. Stay tuned for our next show, another great one, as we talk about Better, the Not Old Better show. Thanks to all, and remember, offer some kindness, service, and love to everyone you meet. You'll never regret it, and you'll make a difference. Thanks.